This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Thursday threw Turkey support behind Ukraine and warned of the danger of another Chernobyl disaster erupting at a nuclear power plant held by invading Russian forces. The Turkish leader met his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky in Lviv just 2 weeks after flying to Sochi for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, during which the two sides pledged to boost economic cooperation. But Erdogan told reporters that NATO member Turkey remained firmly on Ukraine's side in the conflict and would continue its diplomatic efforts to end the fighting. Witnesses say more than 20 people have been killed in a bombing at a mosque in the Afghan capital of Kabul. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The blast also killed a prominent cleric and wounded dozens of people. One survivor recalled the moment of the blast. It was evening prayer time and I was attending the prayer with others when the explosion happened. It was a very powerful explosion inside the mosque. In the aftermath, outside the mosque, tempers were high as several men carried the coffin of the cleric to be taken away for burial. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. However, the Islamic State has stepped up attacks on the Taliban and civilians since the Taliban took over the country last year. I'm Karen Chamas.
A longtime senior executive at Donald Trump's family business pleaded guilty Thursday to helping it engineer a 15-year tax fraud in an agreement that will require him to testify about the company's business practices. Alan Weisselberg entered his plea to all 15 charges he faced in court in the U.S. state of New York. Though the former chief financial officer at the Trump Organization is not expected to cooperate with prosecutors in their larger probe into Trump himself, his plea will likely strengthen their case. This is VOA News. The suspected assailant of author Salman Rushdie pleaded not guilty Thursday to attempted murder and assault charges at a court hearing in upstate New York. Speaking through his lawyer, the 24-year-old reiterated his plea of not guilty to charges he faces for allegedly storming the stage at a literary event last week and stabbing the British novelist several times in the neck and abdomen. The judge ordered he remain detained without bail. The U.S. government plans to hold trade talks with Taiwan, an island China claims as its own. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
The announcement comes after an angry Beijing held military drills following this month's visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Taiwan is currently the U.S.'s ninth largest trading partner, and being allowed to export the U.S. help Taiwan blunt China's efforts to use its status as the island's biggest trading partner as political leverage. China blocked imports of Taiwanese citrus and other food in retaliation for Pelosi's visit, and U.S.-Chinese relations are at their lowest level in decades. I'm Donna Warder.
Massive wildfires in Portugal and Spain were largely under control Thursday after forcing thousands from their homes and destroying large swaths of land. The fires in both countries followed punishing heat waves and long dry spells, leaving forests parched and primed to burn. Forecasters are predicting a fresh heat wave Saturday, the latest in a string of hot spells in Portugal this year. A new study shows bees are increasingly stressed by climate change. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Researchers took photos of thousands of bumblebees to study the evolution of their shape during the 20th century. Aoife Cantwell-Jones at Imperial College in London noticed bees were different during times that were hot and wet.
The wings are more different on the same bee, so this kind of could be an indicator that bees maybe had a bit more stress in those years that were hotter and wetter.
The bumblebee specimens date from 1900 to 2000. Experts say dead bumblebees are easy to preserve. There's a possibility of other factors contributing to a change in a bee's shape.
Given climate change and given that we're predicted to have a lot more hot weather, I think we could be a bit worried about how bees are doing in the future.
According to the United Nations, a third of the world's food production depends on pollination from bees, and their population has been declining for more than a decade. I'm Ed Donahue.
And recapping our top story, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Thursday threw Turkey's support behind Ukraine and warned of the danger of another Chernobyl disaster erupting at a nuclear power plant held by invading Russian forces. His talks with Zelensky and visiting UN Chief Antonio Guterres came with global alarm. Via report.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The level of transparency was quite remarkable. They actually posted all of the forms that they received from the over 46,000 polling stations around the country on their website.
That's Saskia Breckenmacher with the Carnegie Foundation's Democracy, Conflict and Governance Program speaking about Kenya's election process. Details coming up also. The Liberian president has suspended three of his officials after the U.S. announced sanctions on them. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Angolans will head to the polls on Wednesday, August 24th, to choose a new president and parliament. While there are eight parties on the ballot, this election is largely a race between the ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola Party, or MPLA, and the main opposition National Union for the Total Independence of Angola Party, or UNITA. The two sides fought each other in a brutal civil war that ended in 2002. President João Lourenço of the MPLA, the hand-picked successor of the late former president José Eduardo dos Santos, is vying for re-election. He faces off against UNITA's charismatic new leader, Adalberto Costa Jr. VOA's Heidi Adams takes a look.
Angola's ruling MPLA in the final stretches of campaigning. As President João Lourenço seeks to serve a second term. 5 years ago, he came into office declaring war on corruption, nepotism, impunity, and promising to reform Angola's battered economy. The MPLA has had an unbroken hold on power since Angola gained independence from Portugal in 1975. The party won just over 61% of the vote in the 2017 general election. The opposition, UNITA, took about 27% of the vote. Lourenço now faces a challenge from UNITA's charismatic new leader, Adalberto Costa Jr. Popular amongst Angola's fast-growing urban youth, Costa Jr. is a fierce critic of the ruling party's reforms. Political analyst Marissa Lourenço.
What's been most interesting about him is that he's tried to take the party through a slow modernization. He's someone, you know, that is able to bring a lot of people through to campaign rallies. He engages with people on social media. He's trying to offer a kind of more direct line to the presidency.
Borges Namire from the Institute for Security Studies expects a high voter turnout.
The fact that Adalberto Costa Jr. is so charismatic and is bringing new ideas and is bringing a real possibility of winning the election. It will motivate people from both sides, both UNITA supporters and MPLA supporters, to go to the poll. Because the UNITA, they see, okay, finally we have a leader. A real leader, who they didn't have in the last years.
President Lourenço is being praised abroad for his anti-corruption drive, which he launched shortly after taking office. The government says it has recovered billions of dollars in stolen assets both at home and overseas, as Lourenço went after high-ranking civil servants, ministers, party officials, and members of former President dos Santos's family. Critics, however, say the president's corruption crackdown has been selective and politically motivated, and that his efforts to reform and open up the economy have fallen short.
His administration has been very committed to fiscal prudence, to reducing wasteful expenditure, and that has really paid off very well. You know, so it's helped broad stability, but it hasn't actually trickled down. So it hasn't resulted in increased jobs or increased investment, and this is why we still have very high unemployment.
If the stakes aren't high enough, a survey by the Pan-African Research Network Afrobarometer shows one in five Angolans trusts the country's National Electoral Commission.
The most important is how Angolan will react to the election. So I'm really afraid that we might see a post-electoral violence in Angola, and I hope that it is not going to happen, because that is not good for Angola. That's not good for the continent.
With an estimated 14 million people registered to vote, many are bracing for a tight race in what could be one of the most consequential elections in the Southern African nation's history. Hady Adams, VOA News.
In more news from Angola, Angola and the European Union will start talks for a trade deal this year after EU and African partners approved the request from the oil-producing nation to join a regional trade bloc. An EU spokesperson told Reuters the green light to start negotiations came in late July. The news comes as the Southern African country prepares for general elections next week. The possible deal would likely increase the export of Angolan products to the EU and possibly reduce the dominance of oil, which accounts for nearly all Angola's exports by value. The EU estimates Angolan products such as frozen shrimp, ethyl alcohol, wheat, bran, and bananas are likely to benefit the most if tariffs are lifted. With the boost in trade expected from the deal and EU's increased need for fuel amid the energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine, Angola also might export more oil to the 27-nation bloc. Currently, China is by far its largest customer. Also, Spanish judge yesterday ruled the death of Angola's former president José Eduardo dos Santos in Barcelona in July was from natural causes and allowed the repatriation of his body. Dos Santos, who stepped down 5 years ago, died on July 8th at the age of 79 in Barcelona. Exiled Chadian rebel leader Timan Erdemi has returned to the country after a decade in exile in Qatar for talks aiming to pave the way for democratic elections. But as Victoria Amunga reports from VOA's African Center in Nairobi, boycotts by rebel and opposition groups remain major hurdles.
67-year-old Timan Erdemi returned Thursday ahead of Saturday's anticipated landmark talk in N'Djamena, Chad's capital. Erdemi, who heads the Union of Resistance Forces, widely known as UFR, is accused of leading an armed group that attempted twice to overthrow the Chadian government in 2008 and 2019. Comprising at least 40 rebel groups, Erdemi's UFR signed a peace agreement on August 8th in Doha for talks that will pave the way for elections after 18 months of military rule in Chad. But two of the biggest rebel groups are boycotting the negotiations forum. Agence France Presse has reported that the two groups, Front for Change and Concord in Chad, triggered the 2021 offensive in northeastern Chad that killed longtime leader Idriss Déby Itno. The groups claim the forum is politically biased. The upcoming talks are also expected to bring together 1,400 delegates from the military government, civil society, opposition leaders, and the trade unions. According to General Mahat Idriss Déby, president of Chad's Transitional Military Council, the talks provide a chance for reconciliation in the fractured country. The junta's 18-month windows of transition to democracy expires October, a deadline that France, the African Union, and other stakeholders have urged the president to uphold. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Liberian President George Weah suspended three officials Tuesday after the U.S. government announced sanctions on them for public corruption. The officials include the president's chief of staff, the country's chief prosecutor, and the managing director of Liberia's National Port Authority. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
The suspensions were made less than 24 hours after the U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions on three senior Liberian officials for alleged corruption. Nathaniel McGill, Liberia's Minister of State and the President's Chief of Staff, is accused of a variety of corruption schemes, including directing warlords to threaten public rivals, bribery, and the misappropriation of state assets. Seyma Cephas, Liberia's Solicitor General and Chief Prosecutor, is accused of shielding suspected criminals, blocking investigations into government corruption, and interfering with evidence to ensure the conviction of political rivals. Bill Toway, managing director of Liberia's National Port Authority, is accused of funneling money from the port into private accounts. Ibrahim Nyai is a Liberian political analyst based in Monrovia.
These individuals have been very close to him, members of his kitchen cabinet, and they've been everywhere the president has been. And so his move to suspend them is a tactical move to personally save his integrity, his public image, and to demonstrate that he's intolerant of corrupt activities.
He says he's seen mixed public reaction to the suspensions, with some calling for a criminal investigation. Under the sanctions, all U.S. property and interests in U.S. property of the three officials must be blocked, a Treasury Department statement said. Those who engage in certain transactions with the officials are subject to sanctions themselves. Several Liberian government officials have been sanctioned in the last 2 years, including two senators and a passport director. Othniel Forte is a Liberian historian.
The corruption runs deeper than just those three people. America wants to send a message of change or toughness, but they don't want to hurt the administration badly. They want to make a statement, but nothing so damaging.
The U.S. Treasury Department did not respond to a list of questions, including whether the officials own property that would be affected. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Algeria's Civil Protection Authority is reporting the death toll from forest fires raging in at least 26 provinces of the country has risen to 31 people after a prolonged summer heat wave. Dozens of people reportedly are missing, indicating the death toll is likely to rise further. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Algerian media showed video of fires burning out of control in forests across the country, claiming thousands of acres of woodland and affecting the country's national parks. The death toll is likely to rise further due to the large number of people reported to be missing. Algeria's Interior Minister Kamal Beljoud told journalists that fires were raging unchecked in large swaths of the country and that authorities were still trying to collect data from local officials to determine the number of buildings and other structures that were damaged or destroyed. He says his ministry received reports of 106 fires spreading across the country in Skikda, Jijil, Setif, Tarf, Su'aras, and Tipaza, and it's not immediately clear how many structures were affected by the fire as yet. Ibtissam Hamlawi, who heads Algeria's Red Crescent Society, told state TV that her organization is well positioned to deal with such a crisis and is busy sending volunteers to help in areas affected by the fires, in addition to sending aid supplies to those families worst hit by the tragedy. She says that the Red Crescent began sending aid to those affected by the fires early Thursday, including 20 tons of medicine, mattresses and blankets, foodstuffs and water to the region of Tarf in the east of the country. Egyptian political sociologist Said Sadik, who is now based in Tunisia, tells VOA that summer temperatures in parts of North Africa, including Algeria and Tunisia, have been unprecedented, and this has contributed to conditions favorable for wildfires.
The whole area of North Africa, from Morocco to Algeria to Tunisia, they are facing big challenges. The weather is changing, and they are suffering from water shortage and extreme heat, rising heat that are pushing them.
Sadik noted that both Tunisia and Morocco are rationing water because of lengthy droughts and dry weather conditions and are contributing to making forest areas prone to wildfires. Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya were badly hit by wildfires in 2021 caused by similar climatic conditions. Numerous wildfires have been reported this year in parts of Europe, including France and Italy, because of high temperatures and drought. Last year, Algerian media said a drone was spotted setting some of the forest fires and reported that parts of the damaged plane subsequently were recovered after it crashed. Authorities are looking into the reports to see if there is a connection. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Saskia Breckenmacher is a fellow in Carnegie's Democracy, Conflict and Governance program, where her research focuses on gender, civil society and democratic governance. She has advised major governmental and private funders on strategies to protect and defend civic space in countries experiencing democratic backsliding. She recently wrote about Kenya, an article titled "The Specter of Politics as Usual in Kenya's 2022 Election." She shared some of her thoughts regarding Kenya's close election with me.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it was a very important election because we knew that no matter the outcome, Kenyatta couldn't run again. So there was going to be a change in leadership no matter what. And so the stakes of the election were quite high. We also knew it was going to be a close race. The opinion polls throughout the spring showed that they were really Ruto and Odinga were neck to neck, that it was going to be potentially a very, very close election and potentially even a runoff, right, if none of the candidates met the 50% threshold. But then the results came in. It took a little bit of time for the Electoral Commission to count all the votes. We now heard the announcement from the IEBC chairman that current Deputy President William Ruto has indeed won the election based on that announcement. But as you may have seen in the news, the result is being contested.
So, Sasika, actually explain to me this Electoral and Boundaries Commission, the IEBC. And you wrote in your piece where you mentioned that does the commission have the capability or the credibility to manage a potentially close election?
Yes, that was one of the question marks in the lead up to the election. For those who have followed Kenyan politics for a while, know that, you know, the past few elections, there's always been contestation of the results, and there's been various problems with the vote counting process. Famously, last time in 2017, the Supreme Court actually annulled the elections, and the presidential election was held again because there had been issues with the vote transmission process. So this time around, you know, there was a lot of anticipation. What would this look like? Would those problems be solved? And it's important to note that the IEBC, the Electoral Commission, as you say, put a lot of effort into increasing the transparency of the vote counting process, anticipating, I think, some of those challenges. So the level of transparency was quite remarkable. They actually posted all of the forms that they received from the over 46,000 polling stations around the country on their website. And citizens and media houses could sort of follow along as they were getting those forms and were uploading them. And they uploaded them fairly fast. So last week, as analysts and observers were following the elections, I think there was a lot of praise for, you know, how the process had actually improved. But then this week, as we got closer to the announcement of the results, as you said, there was actually a fair amount of turmoil that broke out. First, we saw that a number of media houses who'd been sort of doing a parallel count of the votes stopped counting and didn't actually end up announcing who had won the election. Then shortly before the IEBC was meant to make the announcement, four of the commissioners sort of left the tallying center and made a separate announcement saying that they could not sign on to the final announcement of the results, which obviously caused a lot of chaos, as people had not expected that. And it wasn't quite clear what they were basing it on. They were basically just saying there'd been problems of transparency and the process had been opaque. And then the IEBC chairman nevertheless went ahead and announced the election results. My understanding is that is his constitutional right and duty as the chairperson. He's the returning officer for the presidential election. But as you know, it obviously cast a shadow on the election, the fact that there was this kind of splintering among the commissioners.
And, you know, like Ruto is acting like a president-elect. He's going about his business. He's saying we cannot waste time.
Yes, good question. I mean, for now, he is the president-elect, but as I noted, there is a challenge. My understanding is if they do file a petition, I think they have about a week to do so, starting yesterday, then there'll be a time period in which the judges, you know, have to respond. I think it would take about 21 days or so for there to be a final kind of verification or announcement about the election. So there is this kind of period of uncertainty now where, yes, on the one hand, there is a president that's been announced. There have been a number of heads of state who have congratulated him and sort of, you know, accepted the result as it was announced. But there are also others, it's important to note, who have held back and have so far just said, you know, we congratulate the Kenyan citizens, the Electoral Commission on conducting the election, but, you know, want to wait and kind of follow through with the dispute resolution process until we congratulate the official winner. So I think there is just this period now where it's important just to follow the official processes that exist for exactly such a scenario.
That was Saskia Breckenmacher, a fellow in Carnegie's Democracy, Conflict and Governance program. She talked to me from Washington. At least 77 people have been killed and 14,500 homes destroyed by Sudan's seasonal downpours and floods. Brigadier General Abdul Jalil Abdul Rahim, spokesman for Sudan's National Council for Civil Defense, says the provinces most affected include South Kordofan, South Darfur, and River Nile. The Associated Press reports the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said more than 136,000 people have been affected by floods in the eastern Sudan and Kordofan states. The UN agency expects this figure to increase as the counting is still underway and heavy rains are expected. Sudan's rainy season usually lasts until September, with floods peaking just before then. Last year, flooding and heavy rain killed more than 80 people and swamped tens of thousands of houses across the country. In 2020, authorities imposed a three-month state of emergency across the country after floods killed around 100 people and inundated over 100,000 houses. In Guinea, an opposition coalition says security forces shot dead a protester yesterday. The National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, FNDC, says a young man was killed in demonstrations in the Wanindara suburb outside Conakry. Reuters news agency says the police have not commented on the shooting, which the country's main human rights watchdog also confirmed. The wire service says it was the third deadly protest since June. Groups have been calling on the military to return Guinea to civilian rule. The FNDC says at least four people were killed and several wounded in protests last month. Guinea's military took power in a coup last year from long-serving President Alpha Conde. A mediator from the regional bloc ECOWAS is expected to arrive on Sunday to help negotiate a return to democracy. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.